There are two schools of thought relating to extraordinary extroversions of emotion. One school teaches that the individual should correct these things in himself and not burden society with them. The other school, which has a large following today, takes the ground that whatever we feel, we should say. If we don't like something, we should complain bitterly. And if we regard ourselves as injured or abused, we should retaliate in every way possible. This is sort of extroversion. A good example of it is the modern terrorist movements in various nations. They are the ones who feel that a complaint should be aired in its full meaning and dignity. This may be a way that appeals to persons who are not especially thoughtful, but I think that the wiser part of mankind has always explained the matter as something that should be worked over, contained, and transmuted within the life and character of the person himself. Now, there's no doubt in the world that the temptations to be unpleasant or unhappy are numerous. They are, so to say, initiations or tests. Our weaknesses are the primary reason why we're here, because, as the ancients certainly considered it, this world is a place of testing. It is a sphere in which we have the privilege of exhibiting the best of our own conduct, and most of all, the privilege of solving problems without unusual disturbance. Actually, to many folks, the problem of anger is one of those difficult pressures of the personality which are difficult indeed to transmute or to control. When we are unhappy or angry, critical, condemnatory, self-pitying, the whole of our libido flows into these attitudes. We seem to have no resistance to them. We feel as though a pressure greater than we can control is operating through us. And because of our psychological orientation, we feel that these pressures, or this pressure, is quite proper, reasonable, and appropriate to the situation. Usually when you discuss a problem of disposition with a person in difficulties, and he tells what he has done, and you explain that that was not the wisest way he could have handled a situation, he looks at you very innocently and says, "Well, I just can't help it." And most of our troubles, to a measure at least, come under the conviction that we just cannot help being ourselves. Now, it's somewhat difficult to assume that ourselves, in the best sense of the term, have bad dispositions. They do not. The internal life of man is sustained by law and order. The person themselves is never in a condition in which they cannot control their own feelings, that is, unless a distinct pathology exists. The real answer is that self-discipline is a tedious frustration of our feelings. We do not like to assume that it is our responsibility to act better than we feel. But the answer, of course, lies in the control of the way we feel, and not a control of the tongue or of some external factor of communication. We have to realize also that all dispositional inconsistencies are penalized. No matter how we approach the situation, it becomes obvious that nature wishes us to have good dispositions. And if we fail to meet nature's wish in this matter, nature has a way of enforcing its attitude or its policy in connection with human life. The body itself, the physical body, is usually the primary victim of emotional intemperance. The body is damaged by any unreasonable, stressful, negative expression of emotion. Now, nature tells us in a very simple way that this damage is inevitable, regardless of the motives which are impelling a wrong attitude. We may feel perfectly confident that our position is correct, but if our disposition is not under control, various after effects are very serious. For example, a person who has high blood pressure and a bad temper is compounding a difficulty. Under the stress of emotion, the high blood pressure can result in irreparable damage to the heart or the brain. The fact that the emotion seems to be justified does not prevent the damage. Nature, therefore, is not to be bribed by some apology, by some personal interpretation of feelings which are contrary to natural law. The law of nature is very simple and direct. Human beings must live together in peace or perish. This is obvious on a political level. It is obvious in the psychological pressures of nations, and it is equally obvious in the home or within the actual physical structure of the human being. Nearly all of the discordant political factions that are disturbing us today feel that they have legitimate grievances. They have been wronged, injured, slighted sometime along the way of history. Sometimes the damage was done centuries ago. In other cases, it appears to be contemporary. But whatever be the historical background for the situation, the fact remains that any failure of internal composure is likely to thrust a major disaster upon mankind. Various attempts have been made to estimate the effect of emotional pressure on the individual. Delicate mechanisms are now available in which these pressures can be recorded, estimated, and diagnosed. They also occur frequently in psychological counseling. And a sincere and honest counselor realizes that he cannot change the disposition of another person. He can advise change. He can perhaps give some useful suggestions as to how this change can be accomplished. But if the person involved resolves not to change or lacks the strength of character to make a correction possible, the condition remains. So in this particular problem this morning, we wanted to handle or consider some of the personal factors. We can see the larger picture around us, where enmities, antagonisms, jealousies, mutually justified, have carried us into the brink of a disaster. We must find the same situation within ourselves. It has been assumed with some validity that the average person is born with a good disposition. Small children are, for the most part, delightful little creatures. They live in a world of wonders beyond our comprehension. They have an internal life which is difficult for us to estimate or understand. Occasionally, by nature, we will get a personality that is congenitally difficult. But for the most part, the small person is amenable to reason and wishes to live pleasantly and happily. What happens then to make this increasingly difficult? Obviously, the first immediate experience of the child is in the home. If the home is discordant, if the relatives are at sword's points with each other, if the home contains a vast amount of complaint or one intensive complainer, this certainly works a serious hardship upon the child. Research indicates that under such circumstances, the child naturally and inevitably rises against discord. It is expressed through tears, sometimes by hysteria. It is also a reproachful attitude of the child toward those around it who are actually unpleasant. After a certain time, however, the child receives a series of disillusioning experiences. The child discovers that its effort to create peace is totally misunderstood. The contending persons may turn upon the child. They may punish the child for trying to arbitrate the difficulties of its parents. At the very best, the child is indoctrinated with the realization that these difficulties are inevitable, that the child growing up will face them also, and that there's no way of solving the problems except on some kind of an intellectual or emotional battlefield. By the time the child is fully indoctrinated with this concept, the character has already been damaged. It becomes adjusted to the inevitability of complaint, that the individual must complain his way through life. Also, it is witness to a gladiatorial combat of wills in which there is a tremendous battle of one mind against another. Sometimes this battle is very obvious, sometimes subtle. In some cases, it is a sudden and spontaneous outburst, and in other cases, it is a long, lingering determination to injure, damage, or in some way work a retribution upon another person. Starting out with this environment, we can see why the average individual does not develop in early life those resources which would protect it against the emergence of destructive feelings and attitudes from within himself. The beginning, naturally, is in the beginning of life itself. But the average person who is concerned with these matters is no longer in childhood. They are in midstream somewhere in the course of life. And they are mostly concerned with the inevitable discomforts which return to themselves and which they are not able to assimilate constructively. Once the person starts a line of criticism or condemnation, the circumstances around them begin to be adversely affected. The individual against whom the attitude is directed retaliates, thus compounding a felony. Retaliation is also considered to be quite natural, quite normal, and almost inevitable. But it is only almost inevitable because the average individual is not developing the normal resources with which he has been endowed. It is inevitable for the person on the level of his own action to act differently from the way he reacts to circumstances. But it is always a privilege and an opportunity to rise to a better level by which these difficulties can be arbitrated successfully. So we have in all of this type of situation to consider with the greatest care how nature handles the matter. That's the first consideration. Nature is sometimes subtle, but usually rather obvious. Nature simply rewards the bad disposition with that type of circumstance to which it is properly entitled. In other words, it surrounds the individual with increasing difficulties arising from within the person himself, distributed through his environment, and reacting back upon himself. It seems, therefore, that the dispositional factor is part of a vicious circle of consequences. If the person is constructive, well-intentioned, by nature kindly and thoughtful, he will gradually discover that this type of situation, this level of understanding, is in his environment as well as within himself. He stimulates good in others by using the good in himself. He stimulates discord in others when he stimulates the discord in himself. Nature has set this up as the last and final solution to all human problems, namely that the human being must grow or suffer. There is no excuse in nature. There is no real ability to prevent effects following their causes. And wherever an emotion is set in motion, the effect will be consistent with the emotion itself. A series of negative thoughts will not produce a positive end. A series of destructive attitudes will never lead to peace. A continual pressure of immaturity within the person will only accomplish maturity as a result of pain. All these things being true, nature sets the stage. Nature tells us what we can do and has given us great codes of law and revelation to guide us in this search for internal integrity. We have the Golden Rule. We have the Sermon on the Mount. We are told in all religions to not only love our friends, but to do good to those who despitefully use us. This last part is not so frequently quoted, because in many instances where the person claims to be devoutly religious, he never can quite get around to forgiving his enemy. If we go a little further into the matter and we recognize that this is the way that nature works, then we begin to study the forms of punishment which nature affects or inflicts upon those who disobey its rule. A bad disposition or lack of control nearly always becomes habit-forming. Very few individuals in the course of life have only one bad moment. These moments increase gradually as we permit them to dominate our attitudes. What it might be at first a brief hysteria or a sudden and dynamic conflict becomes a policy. Little by little, the whole mind not only nurses its grievances, but begins to look for more grievances. Not satisfied with the difficulties that it has, it goes out and discovers or invents further difficulties. By the time a person with a bad temper has indulged this for, say, 20, 30 years, it is no longer a person with a bad temper. It is a bad temper to which a person is appended. The temper becomes the important factor. It is the temper that becomes alive and the person becomes only a servant of it. As we go along watching these procedures, we are forced to recognize that these intemperances begin to pile up and become policies in ourselves. I know cases of people who have come to me who admit, under pressure, that they have wrecked three homes with their own bad dispositions. They knew what caused it, or at least had a theoretical concept of it, but the new home went the same way. They were never able to actually vitalize remedy. They vitalized the difficulty, but never the solution. So we find that anger begets anger. It becomes more common. And the individual who tries to extrovert through this type of emotion finds that he is called upon to do so more and more frequently. And he can become an addict to his own disposition, with damage to all concerned. Another problem that arises is the inevitable reaction of vibratory pressures within the person. Attitudes are rates of vibration, by means of which the normal rhythms of the body are overdeveloped or depressed. The individual has a normal, proper heartbeat. If he is highly depressed, the heartbeat is afflicted. If he becomes excited, particularly destructively, the heartbeat is overstimulated. Now, there are times and moments when stimulation may be benevolent. The individual falling in love certainly passes through a strong emotional pressure. But this pressure is supported by nature. It is part of a plan for things. It is not inordinate. It is controllable. It gradually subsides if it's excessive. It gradually builds up if it is not excessive, until a normal point is reached. And in such cases, the emotion being basically constructive, the consequences in the body are basically constructive. Nature deals out rewards and punishments on a merit system completely. On the side of the depressant person or of the extrovert on negative situations, the vibratory rates are confused, broken. The rhythms become dissonant. And the individual's temper fit reminds one a little bit of one of our ultra-modern musical compositions. It is noise, discord, a thunderous violation of the laws of harmony. This does not work any permanent good upon society. In fact, it is today one of the contributing forces towards the general demoralization of the younger generation. If music was harmonious, it would inspire. When it is dissonant, it definitely injures. When the emotions of the individual are constructive, then there is a kind of psychological or psychic music which is harmonious. But when the attitudes are frictional, dissonant, discordant, unrhythmic, then the consequences are damage and danger to the body. Now, the body may survive these dangers to a certain degree. Some people, more than perhaps we realize, come to a coronary through a bad outbreak of dispositional pressure. Others may gradually build up a certain immunity to this type of result, but it does not mean that they are not damaged. They are damaged in several ways, and nature has a kind of analogy between the levels of thinking and the functions of the body. Every attitude seems to have a physical correspondent in our structure, so that all attitudes have their physiological and anatomical analogies. This means that these attitudes affect various organs in various parts of the body according to the quality and type of reaction that has been stimulated. The ancients summed this up by dividing the body among the planets. And each planet had its keynote or keyword. And this planet bestowed certain virtues or powers upon man. And these virtues were distributed through the various corresponding organs of the body. As each planet has an emotional keynote, so the corresponding function in the body or organ, as the case may be, is either inspired or disturbed. If then we carry on a certain negative attitudes, we come in the end, perhaps, to the final harvest. And that is, in older years, one of two things is going to happen. The individual is either going to be sick or else he's going to be difficult to live with. Now, if he's sick, he has had trouble living with himself. If he is not physically sick, then he has trouble living with other people. And it is more or less obvious that as the individual grows older, his petulances have a tendency to escape more and more from the control of his mind and his constructive attitudes. He has more tendency to drift back into habitual ways. If he has been a critic all his life, he will become a greater and more intensive critic as he grows older. If he, however, has lived a very gentle and kindly life, free from pressures, very often he drifts along through his closing years in a kind of pleasant fantasy in which the good he has done returns to him. This type of reaction is important. It's not so important to the teenager or the person in their early 20s, but the person who must live with the consequences of the effect of disposition upon function sometimes has a rather bad time of it. And even under the best conditions, with the complete patience of other people, there is loneliness, there is a certain kind of isolation, there is a failure of friendships, there is a more or less fatalistic sense of despair that arises as the consequence of living out an inadequate psychology of life. Now, one of the basic remedies, of course, for all of this is religion. Religion, by its own nature, is twofold, and we must try to understand that where religion is an inclusive spiritual conviction that deals with principles and the proper manifestation of these principles, it is the most constructive force in the life of the person. If his religion, however, is in conflict, if he is more or less a religious fanatic, if he limits his spiritual viewpoint to some inadequate creed which demands nothing of himself except allegiance, he will then perhaps gain nothing and even lose some of the values he would naturally have. Religion, in substance, then, gives the person a relationship with life. A truly religious person who believes in God cannot believe in violence. He may feel, of course, that in nature around him there is violence. But he must also realize that because within himself there is a divine principle, that it is not necessary that he accept violence as a way of life or permit it to emerge from himself as a way of character or living. Actually, faith in a divine principle of good has a strong tendency to transmute the feelings of personal grievance. If God is in his heavens and the God in man is normally functioning, the individual has no need to fall into despondencies or irritations or aggravations or recriminations. He has a right to recognize that there is a divine plan And religion is truly obedience to that plan and not membership in a sect. And if the religion says, love your neighbor, you love your neighbor. If religion says, love your enemy, you love your enemy. But usually at this point, piety breaks down. The individual cannot resist the inclination to return evil for evil. As the old Greeks pointed out, an evil plus an evil equals two evils. They do not in any way neutralize each other. This being true, the whole thing seems to come right back to the fact that we should sit down and say to ourselves, do I want to be happy? Had I rather be happy than miserable? Had I rather be loved than either feared or hated? I would rather be a good friend to my own family and to the families of others than a competitor, one way or another trying to be a domestic politician. Would I rather have good health in which to enjoy my years, or would I prefer to see my health gradually disappear? And if I have good health, in spite of a bad disposition, do I want my life simply to be longer in order that I can have the bad disposition a little longer? These are decisions that each person has to make. They cannot be made by another. But nature gives us inspiration to make the constructive decisions. The poets, the philosophers, the mystics of all time have described in words and visions the good way of life. And in all instances, they have declared that the real way is peace. Peace in yourself. Peace on earth and goodwill to men. Goodwill to others is, of course, almost always under the pressure of anger. When we become angry, goodwill to others evaporates. And we live very largely for that triumphant moment when we have had a victory over an adversary. People who win a negative debate sometimes have the most happy look on their faces that you can imagine. The jaw sets a little bit, the eyes sparkle, and the individual has won a fencing match. What he has done to the other person is of no concern to him. Because whatever they got out of it that wasn't pleasant, they deserved. But the victory won by violence is the same thing as a victory won by Napoleon or one of the other great conquerors. It is a victory floating for a moment on the surface of inevitable defeat. So that there should be no satisfaction in the performance of a destructive action or the expression of a destructive attitude. Beginning then with the realization that probably most people, even after a long, uncertain life, want to make peace with themselves, make peace with their God, and live in harmony with their neighbor. These being the natural desires of the individual, it follows that every possible means should be used to see that these desires are nurtured and come finally to full expression. They should become the ruling powers of life. Actually, also, that peculiar psychological entity within man termed the soul has a place in this. It has always been assumed that the soul is a principle of good, that the soul is the best and better part of the corporeal complex. The soul is the leader of the bodies. It is the herald that announces the glad tiding. The soul being by nature good, and being a direct progeny of the divine good, and all souls having their root in the soul of God, in absolute benevolence, The soul in man wants peace. It wants love, friendship. It wants inspiration. It wants to expend itself in the common service of others. As in the case of the motto of the Prince of Wales, "Ich dien," I serve, is the motto of the soul. The soul wishes to give rather than to take. It wishes to help rather than to hinder. It wishes to devote its energies and powers to the improvement of all that lives, not the gratification of its own attitudes. The soul, therefore, is imprisoned within the body of the person who acts contrary to it. The soul is deformed or degraded by abuse of its powers. And this constant factor is present in what we might and often do like to regard as conscience. Conscience, according to the ancients, was a name for the soul. It was that something inside of you that doesn't agree with you when you do not do right. And it has been said in recent years that the conscience is a small, still voice that gets smaller and stiller all the time. But it is there. And there is inevitably within the individual a tiny shock of some nature when he makes a serious abuse of his own abilities. Something inside of the individual tells him to do right. But usually the inner voice is not more successful than the legislative structure of the environment. The individual still does what he pleases. The answer to this, of course, is that he must please to do that which is right. He must have a pleasure in peace instead of finding satisfaction in discord. To build such a concept in himself requires a considerable amount of self-control. It requires also sometimes a little bit of fear. Fear is not a good emotion in itself, but an anxiety concerning the state of self is sometimes benevolent. When a person begins to realize that what he is doing is getting him into increasing difficulties, and he proceeds along the way, certain anxieties arise within him. He likes to push these anxieties away, always transferring responsibility to something or someone else. But in the course of time, when the mysterious ills which he has fashioned come back upon himself, he is subject to anxiety. He wishes to find a solution. He is like an alcoholic who has finally discovered that he has a habit that is killing him. Now, an alcoholic who makes this discovery either kills himself because he says he cannot change, or perhaps with the last flash of integrity in himself, joins Alcoholics Anonymous or some other similar group and tries desperately with the cooperation of other people to restore his own self-dignity. Now, alcohol, narcotics, things of these kinds are recognized dangers, but it is not realized usually. The disposition is just as dangerous as a narcotics addiction. Unless it can be tempered and educated, things do not go well. Education doesn't seem to help this situation. The child coming out into the world is taught conflict. He is taught that if it does not fight its way, it won't get there. It is taught to view a competitor as an enemy. Gradually, it also learns that laws, as they are enforced in society, are enemies because they interfere with his doing exactly as he pleases. So various resentments set in, and instead of realizing that he should be obedient, he glorifies disobedience, making it a symbol of individual achievement. having reached the point where he cares about nothing but himself, he regards his career as well on its way to success. This type of thinking is not being corrected. The philosophical systems of the past that had much to do with this are no longer active. Most philosophy is now dominated by do-what-you-please attitudes. Philosophy is the justification of our mistakes rather than an inspiration toward the correction of them. So the academic systems of today make bad matters worse. And by the time the person goes out into life to assume the responsibilities of living, he goes as a lamb to the slaughter. He goes full of false notions which he tries to live up to. He goes into a conflict with those around him. He has a wrong interpretation of marriage and a wrong interpretation of parental responsibility. He is living forever to do as he pleases. But life that is valuable is not a life of infinite opportunity alone, but a life of continuing responsibility. Very often dispositions resent responsibility. They do not want to curtail the satisfaction of their personal attitudes or the continuance of dominant habits. But unless these are controlled, unless these are corrected, life is not going to be successful. How we can work with this problem, wherever it shows up, is almost always an internal experience. There are many cases, for example, where an agnostic or a person with very little religious background has become variously dominated by a strong religious experience. The transforming power of a mystical experience is difficult to overestimate. The individual having a flash of light from within his own soul very often can change and mend his ways. Some of the greatest saints in the hagiology were among the most prominent sinners of their time. But something happened. Now, what happens, usually, is a head-on collision with tragedy. It is something by which the individual, going along his way, selfish and thoughtless and careless, suddenly confronts an issue that moves him to his very foundations. Something that he cannot cope with by the shallow thinking or feeling that he has had during life. An example of this is the case of a very nagging couple in which the nagging went so far that one member of the team took the attitude that they were completely empowered to dominate the life of the other. Then suddenly, the dominated person died. This was a very critical moment because the survivor did care for that person who passed on, but became more and more obsessed with the belief that they were responsible for his death. They looked back upon all the nagging, unpleasant things they had done. They came to me and told me of the selfishness which had dominated their relationships. Now, this survivor was the one who always got their own way and was thoughtless, and that when the deceased was ill, they assumed it was imagination and would not even have proper medical care.